The sea breeze off Kingston Harbor carried more than salt. It carried sound. Laughter from street vendors, the call of fishermen hauling nets, and somewhere in the distance, the faint rhythm of a guitar cutting through the evening air. In Greenwich Town, music wasn't something you went to find. It was already in your lungs, your skin, your bones. In 1947, a boy named John Holt took his first breaths in that soundscape. He didn't grow up with fame in mind. He grew up with hymns in church, American R&B on late-night radio, and the pulse of Jamaican mento and ska echoing through the lanes. His voice, smooth and steady, began turning heads before he even knew what a microphone felt like. This episode follows Holt from those formative streets to the heart of Jamaica's emerging music scene. We'll walk with him into the small, crowded halls of early talent shows, where winning wasn't as important as winning over the crowd. We'll stand beside him as he joins the Paragons, shaping rocksteady harmonies that would define an era. And we'll step into the studio on the night The Tide Is High was recorded, a song that would one day circle the globe. Then, just when it seemed the harmony was set for life, Holt stepped out of the group's shadow, alone on stage for the first time, with nothing but his voice and the crowd's curiosity. He began building a solo career that would carry him further than he'd ever imagined. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 1. Roots in Kingston. Greenwich Town, late 1940 to 1950. The sea air in Greenwich Town always carried a mix of salt, diesel, and frying fish. It was a neighborhood perched on the edge of Kingston's harbor, a working-class stretch where life moved to the sound of hammers against boat hulls, the cries of market women, and the occasional blast from a passing ship. This was where John Holt first opened his eyes in 1947, in a Jamaica still feeling the tremors of the Second World War. The island was technically still a British colony, but its people were beginning to lean more heavily into their own voice, in politics, in trade, and especially in music. I'm standing on those same streets decades later, notebook in hand, trying to picture what they looked like in Holt's time. The shoreline is the same, the sea still restless against the pier, but the houses have changed. Many of the original wooden board homes are gone, replaced by cement blocks painted in bright Caribbean colors. But the spirit, the steady hum of community, is still here. I imagine a young boy running barefoot along these lanes, chasing after friends, his voice already carrying the clarity that would one day fill concert halls. In the Kingston of Holt's childhood, the city center was a bustling, noisy mix of street vendors, dock workers, and school children in crisp uniforms. Greenwich Town itself was a self-contained community. If you grew up here, you knew everyone. And if you could sing, word spread quickly. Early family life. John Holt was the youngest of several children, born into a family that lived simply but worked hard. His father found work at the docks, offloading cargo ships under the blistering Caribbean sun. His mother managed the home and sold small goods in the local market. In households like theirs, music wasn't a luxury. It was woven into daily life. Hymns were sung during evening prayers, mento tunes played at Saturday gatherings, and neighbors often sang together while working. Holt's earliest memories of music came from his mother's voice. She wasn't a professional singer, but she had a warm, steady tone and a way of bending notes that made even familiar hymns sound fresh. Sunday mornings meant church, and church meant music, organs, tambourines, and a congregation singing in harmonies that seemed to lift the roof. For young John, it wasn't simply the sound that mattered. It was the way songs brought people together, how voices from different corners of the neighborhood merged into something bigger than any one person. Greenwich Town's tight-knit nature meant that elders kept an eye on the youth. If John skipped a school lesson, someone would tell his parents before the day was done. If he sang at a street corner and someone recognized a natural gift, they made sure his family knew. This quiet network of care helped shape Holt's discipline and gave him a sense of responsibility from an early age. Evenings at home were modest. Dinner might be fish caught earlier in the day, yam, or breadfruit roasted over an open flame. Afterward, the family would sit together, sometimes listening to the radio if they could get a clear signal, other times talking or singing. Electricity was unreliable, so on dark nights, lantern light cast warm glows across the small wooden rooms. In that glow, Holt's imagination grew. Childhood environment. In the 1950s, Greenwich Town was alive with music, but not in the way we think of today. There were no giant speakers pounding bass lines into the night just yet. Instead, music moved through narrow lanes in the voices of men playing acoustic guitars, women humming while washing clothes, and fishermen whistling as they mended nets. Ska had not yet taken over Jamaica, but Mento was a mainstay and American R&B, carried over the airwaves from Florida and New Orleans, was beginning to sneak into local ears. Holt, like many boys his age, became fascinated with these sounds. The radio, when it worked, brought in the voices of Sam Cooke, Nat King Cole, and the Drifters. Their smooth harmonies and heartfelt delivery left a mark on him. The local school John attended had a small music program. It wasn't much, a handful of instruments and a teacher who doubled as choir director. But it was enough to give him structure. His teacher noticed his pitch and tone early on, and often called on him to lead class songs. That recognition boosted his confidence, though Holt himself remained quiet and humble. Markets were another source of musical inspiration. On weekends, vendors gathered not just to sell goods but to socialize. Fiddlers, drummers, and singers would set up near the stalls, turning an ordinary shopping trip into a mini-concert. John would stand close, studying how the older men kept time with their feet, how they shifted from one song to another without losing the crowd's attention. The streets themselves were a classroom. He saw how music could calm disputes, draw people together, and mark important moments. In a place where money was scarce, music was one of the few riches everyone could share. First signs of musical talent. John's first stage was a church pulpit. At around age 8, he began singing solos during Sunday services. His voice was high and clear, with a natural vibrato that made older church members take notice. Soon after, he was invited to sing at school concerts. By his early teens, he was entering local talent contests, a popular form of entertainment across Kingston. One of these contests, held in a neighborhood hall, was a turning point. The prize wasn't money, but a chance to record a song at a small local studio. Holt didn't win that night, but the crowd's reaction stayed with him. People he didn't know came up afterward to shake his hand and tell him to keep going. That encouragement mattered more than any trophy. Back on the streets, Holt sang with friends at evening hangouts. They would gather on a corner, harmonizing to popular American songs and experimenting with local styles. It was here that he began to understand harmony, rhythm, and the importance of blending voices, skills that would later serve him well in the Paragons. Some elders in the neighborhood began calling him the boy with the golden voice. The nickname stuck, and with it came a certain responsibility. People expected him to sing at events, whether he was ready or not. This expectation forced him to practice, to refine his tone, and to take music seriously. Post-war Jamaica and music scene. By the late 1950s, Jamaica was in transition. Political movements were pushing toward independence, which would finally come in 1962. In the streets, that energy translated into music. The sound systems were beginning to rise. Large speaker setups that played records at outdoor dances. Ska, with its brisk tempo and upbeat horns, was gaining popularity. But in communities like Greenwich Town, the older styles still held sway, and Holt grew up in a mix of tradition and innovation. Musical gatherings weren't just about entertainment. They were about identity. Young people were blending influences from American rhythm and blues with local folk traditions, creating something uniquely Jamaican. For Holt, these events were an education in more than just music. They were lessons in crowd dynamics, cultural pride, and the role of art in political expression. Money was tight and opportunities were few, but the sense of possibility was real. Anyone with talent, drive, and the right break could rise from a Kingston neighborhood to national fame. Holt was beginning to see that path for himself. Standing on the shoreline today, you can still feel the heartbeat of Greenwich Town in the slap of waves against the pier and the voices drifting from open doorways. This is where John Holt's story began, in a place that valued hard work, community, and music in equal measure. His journey from these narrow streets to the world stage was about to take its first major turn. The next chapter would find him stepping into a group that would define an era, the Paragons. Chapter 2, First Steps into Music. A reggae evening in Kingston, late 1950. The hall was small, crowded, and hot. The kind of heat that clung to your shirt and made the wooden floor slick under your shoes. Colored light bulbs dangled from a low ceiling, casting soft red and yellow glows over the crowd. In one corner, a makeshift stage held a microphone propped up with electrical tape and a single speaker humming with feedback. It wasn't much, but to a teenager named John Holt, it might as well have been the National Stadium. The crowd was restless, a mix of teenagers in their best pressed shirts and skirts, and older folks sipping Red Stripe from glass bottles. The host, a local MC with a booming voice, stepped up, calling out the next name in the evening's talent showcase. Holt, just in his early teens, took a deep breath and walked forward. He didn't have a band behind him, only a backing track spun by the DJ, but the moment the first notes played, the noise in the room quieted. He sang an American R&B tune, one he'd learned from listening to late-night radio broadcasts from Miami. His delivery wasn't perfect, but it had something the crowd recognized: sincerity. By the time he finished, the applause was loud enough to drown out the buzzing speaker. He didn't win first prize that night, but for Holt, the real victory was feeling the audience respond. Neighborhood talent shows and early confidence. In the Kingston of Holt's youth, talent contests were more than entertainment. They were a proving ground. You could be a dock worker by day and still be known across the neighborhood for your singing voice if you held your own at a Friday night show. These events were cheap to attend, often organized by community groups or local bar owners, and they drew in crowds eager to hear fresh talent. Holt entered several of these competitions. Sometimes he performed solo, other times he teamed up with friends to harmonize on popular songs. The format was usually simple. Each contestant got one song, sometimes two if the crowd demanded an encore. Judges were informal, usually respected community members or musicians, and the prize was often small: a few pounds, a gift certificate, or a promise of a studio session. For Holt, the real prize was the practice. Standing in front of an audience, learning how to hold a note even when nerves tried to shake it, figuring out when to lean into a lyric to get a reaction. These were skills no classroom could teach. Each contest added a layer to his confidence, even the ones he didn't win. School days and musical encouragement. At school, Holt's talent didn't go unnoticed. His music teacher had a sharp ear and a knack for spotting potential. She often chose him to lead group songs during assemblies. On more than one occasion, she pulled him aside to tell him he had a voice worth something, encouraging him to keep practicing outside of class. Music at school was simple: a few wooden recorders, a battered piano, and an old drum set, but it provided structure. Holt learned timing, pitch, and how to follow cues from other musicians. He also began experimenting with harmony, pairing up with classmates to create layered vocals that mimicked the American doo-wop style. Even in subjects unrelated to music, Holt showed quiet determination. He wasn't the loudest in class, but he paid attention, absorbing details and storing them away. That patience and focus would later serve him in recording studios, where precision was as important as passion. Early bandmates and informal groups. By his mid-teens, Holt began singing with a loose group of neighborhood musicians. They weren't officially a band, more like a rotating set of friends who brought their instruments to whichever yard had space for a practice. A battered acoustic guitar, a pair of conga drums, and voices were all they needed. These sessions often started in the late afternoon and ran until well past dark. Neighbors would lean on fences to listen, children would gather at the edges, and someone would inevitably start selling fried fish or roasted corn to the growing crowd. The group covered popular Mento and Calypso songs, slipped in American hits, and experimented with original lyrics. Through these gatherings, Holt learned the value of musical chemistry. He noticed how certain voices blended better than others, how timing between instruments could lift or sink a song, and how even a small audience reacted differently to upbeat rhythms versus slower ballads. Dance halls and the expanding sound. While street sessions kept him grounded in the community, dance halls exposed Holt to a larger world. These were the venues where sound systems were making their mark. Large wooden speaker boxes pumped out ska, R&B, and local hits to packed rooms. DJs spun records from both Jamaica and abroad, and singers would sometimes take the mic for a live performance between tracks. Holt wasn't yet a featured act, but he studied every performer who stepped on stage. He saw how experienced singers controlled the room, when they spoke to the audience, when they let the music breathe. He noticed which songs drew the biggest reactions and began shaping his own style accordingly. Dance halls also gave him a better understanding of where Jamaican music was headed. Ska was rising fast, blending the upbeat tempo of Mento with the horn-driven punch of jazz and the influence of American rhythm and blues. Holt's natural voice, smooth, melodic, and rich in tone, fit perfectly into this evolving soundscape, preparing for the next step. By the time Holt reached his late teens, he had built a quiet but solid reputation in Kingston's music circles. He wasn't yet a household name, but among musicians and talent scouts, his voice was known. The consistency of his performances, combined with his adaptability, moving seamlessly from American ballads to local ska, made him stand out. It was during this period that whispers began about a vocal group looking for a strong lead singer. That opportunity would lead him to the Paragons, the group that would change his career forever. The road from street corners to professional studios was short in distance, but long in work. John Holt had spent his teenage years building the foundation, learning stagecraft, refining his tone, and understanding the rhythm of an audience. Soon, he would step into the recording booth as part of one of Jamaica's most influential rocksteady groups. The boy from Greenwich Town was about to become a voice that would travel far beyond Kingston's shores. Chapter 3. The Paragons Era Begins. A small Kingston studio, mid-1960. The studio smelled faintly of wood polish and warm electronics. In one corner, a reel-to-reel tape machine waited, its silver spools ready to capture whatever came next. The air was thick with anticipation, the kind that settles in when a group knows they're about to create something important, even if they can't quite see how big it will be. John Holt stood near the single-ribbon microphone, one hand in his pocket, the other resting loosely at his side. Around him were the men who would become his musical family: Tyrone Evans, Howard Barrett, and occasionally Bob Andy. They weren't dressed like stars. There were no flashy suits yet, only neat shirts and well-pressed trousers. But their harmonies? Those were already immaculate. This was the Paragons at the dawn of their era, a group not yet weighed down by fame, but already shaping the sound of what would later be called rocksteady. Joining the group, Holt's invitation to join the Paragons came through a mix of luck and reputation. Tyrone Evans had heard him sing at a small venue and was struck by his control and tone. The group, still in its formative stage, needed a strong lead vocalist who could balance romance with rhythm. Howard Barrett recalled years later, "We knew right away he had something rare. His voice wasn't just good. It was steady, reliable, and it carried emotion without forcing it." Holt accepted quickly, though he understood the stakes. Joining a group meant commitment, long rehearsals, and the unspoken rule that harmony came first. No single voice could overshadow the whole. Defining the Paragons' sound. The Paragons were born in a transitional moment for Jamaican music. Ska was beginning to slow down, making way for rocksteady, a smoother, more soulful style that allowed vocals to shine. This shift played perfectly to Holt's strengths. Rehearsals were serious affairs. They often met in yards or cramped backrooms, practicing for hours until every blend and pause felt natural. The group's sound became defined by tight harmonies, simple but effective arrangements, and a lyrical style that leaned heavily on themes of love, longing, and resilience. Holt's role as lead singer wasn't about dominating the track. It was about guiding it, setting the emotional tone while giving space for the others' harmonies to bloom. First studio sessions. Their early recording days were modest. The studios were small, the equipment basic, but the engineers knew how to make the most of what they had. Songs were often recorded in one or two takes. Mistakes had to be worked around. Editing technology was limited, so the pressure to get it right was immediate. One of the first tracks they cut together showcased Holt's ability to move seamlessly from a smooth verse to a soaring chorus. The engineers noticed it too. "He never strained," one recalled. "His high notes sounded as natural as speaking." These first sessions built the trust between Holt and the rest of the group. They learned each other's timing, when to push, when to pull back, and how to adjust mid-song if something went off. Early performances and building a fan base. Before radio hits, the Paragons built their name live. They performed at community centers, dance halls, and open-air shows, often sharing the bill with other rising stars. Holt had a quiet stage presence. He didn't jump or dance wildly, but his stillness drew attention. When he sang, the audience leaned in, as if not to miss a single word. That ability to hold a crowd without theatrics became part of the group's appeal. The early fan base was a mix of young couples, drawn to the romantic ballads, and music lovers who appreciated the clean, precise harmonies. Word of mouth was powerful. A good performance could double their audience the next time they played. Entering the Rocksteady era. By 1966, Rocksteady was in full swing, and the Paragons were riding the wave. Their music fit perfectly with the slower tempo and more spacious arrangements that defined the genre. The bass lines were warmer, the guitar skank more measured, and the vocal harmonies more prominent. For Holt, this was the ideal environment. The slower pace allowed him to stretch notes, linger on phrases, and let the emotion of a lyric settle before moving on. His ballad style, romantic yet unforced, became a signature of the group's sound. The chemistry that made them work. Success in a vocal group is as much about personality as talent. The Paragons had their disagreements, but they shared a work ethic and mutual respect that kept them together through the demanding early years. Holt's humility played a big role. Despite his standout voice, he never treated himself as the star. That balance made the group stronger, ensuring that every member's contribution mattered. They also shared an instinct for knowing which songs suited them best. They didn't chase trends blindly. They focused on material that matched their style and their strengths. In those first years, the Paragons weren't yet legends. They were four young men in Kingston trying to make music that mattered, and succeeding, one show and one recording at a time. For John Holt, joining the group wasn't just a career move. It was the start of a chapter that would cement his place in reggae history. The next step would take them from local favorites to national icons with a song that would travel the globe. The Tide is High. Chapter 4. The Tide is High. A late night studio in Kingston, 1967. The clock on the wall read just past midnight, but no one seemed to notice. The small Kingston studio was alive with the quiet intensity of a band chasing something special. Cigarette smoke curled lazily toward the ceiling, mingling with the warm scent of wood and hot electrical equipment. John Holt stood close to the microphone, eyes half closed, listening to the soft count-in from the engineer's booth. Behind him, the other members of the Paragons shifted their weight, ready to blend their voices into the harmony they had rehearsed for weeks. They were about to record a song that had begun as a simple idea, a melody Holt had been carrying around for months. In a few short hours, it would become a track that would outlive its creators, a song that would cross oceans, decades, and genres. The Tide is High. The spark of an idea. Holt often described the beginnings of The Tide as high as quiet, almost accidental. He had been walking home one afternoon, humming a tune without thinking, when the opening line came to him. It wasn't a grand moment of inspiration, just a phrase that seemed to carry both calm and longing. The lyrics started to form in his head, simple, conversational, yet filled with emotion. Holt's style had always leaned toward words that people could relate to instantly. He wasn't trying to impress with complexity. He was telling a story anyone could feel. That story, he decided, would be about persistence in love. The imagery of the tide, something constant, powerful, and unrelenting, fit perfectly, bringing it to the Paragons. When Holt shared the idea with Tyrone Evans and Howard Barrett, they immediately saw the potential. The melody was strong, and the lyrics had that balance of romance and strength that the Paragons were becoming known for. The group began working through the arrangement in rehearsals. The verses flowed easily, but finding the right balance in the chorus took time. They wanted it to feel uplifting without losing the smoothness that defined Rocksteady. Howard Barrett later recalled, "We must have sung that chorus 100 times in one night, trying to get the timing right. But when it clicked, we knew it." The recording session. Recording The Tide is High was both simple and demanding. Simple because the song's structure was straightforward. No extended solos, no complicated key changes. Demanding because Rocksteady left no room to hide. Every note, every harmony had to be perfect. The band laid down the rhythm track first. The bass carried a warm, rolling pulse, while the guitar kept a steady skank on the offbeat. A light horn section added color without overpowering the vocals. When it came time for Holt's lead vocal, the studio fell into silence. He delivered the verses with a relaxed confidence, letting the words breathe. In the chorus, his voice rose just enough to lift the song, while the harmonies wrapped around him like a tide themselves. The take they kept wasn't the first, but it wasn't far from it. By the end of the night, they knew they had something worth holding on to. Release and reception in Jamaica. When The Tide is High was released in 1967, it quickly found its place on Jamaican radio. It wasn't the fastest-selling single of the year, but it had staying power. Couples requested it at dances, DJs kept it in their rotation, and soon it became a slow dance favorite. Its charm was in its universality. It spoke to anyone who had ever waited for love, fought for love, or believed in love's return. In local performances, the song became a highlight of the Paragon's set list. Audiences sang along to the chorus, sometimes loud enough to drown out the microphones. Crossing Oceans. The song's journey didn't end in Jamaica. Through the networks of Caribbean migration and record trading, The Tide Is High found its way to the United Kingdom. There, it resonated with the growing reggae and rocksteady scenes in London, Birmingham, and other cities with large West Indian communities. By the early 1970s, it was a cult favorite among UK reggae fans. That reputation would set the stage for its later reinvention by Blondie in 1980. A cover that would top charts worldwide, but still carry the DNA of Holt's original composition. Legacy within the Paragon's era. While The Tide Is High wasn't their only hit, it became the song most associated with the Paragon's name outside Jamaica. For Holt, it was a turning point, proof that his songwriting could travel far beyond Kingston's shores. He remained proud of the track, even as it was reinterpreted by other artists. In interviews years later, he often smiled when talking about it, calling it a song that just wouldn't go away. In that cramped Kingston studio, the Paragons had no idea they were creating a piece of music that would live on for decades. For them, it was just another session, another song to add to their growing catalog. But for the world, it was the beginning of a love affair with a melody and a message that never lost its tide. The success of The Tide Is High would carry the Paragons into a new phase, one where their name meant more than just another group in the rocksteady era. And for John Holt, it was a sign that his voice and his pen were capable of shaping the course of Jamaican music. Chapter 5. Paragon's Peak Years. Kingston, 1968, Outdoor Night Concert. The open-air venue was buzzing long before the first note was played. Strings of colored lights hung between bamboo poles, casting soft glows over a restless crowd. The air was thick with the scent of jerked chicken, roasted corn, and rum punch. Vendors shouted over the din, selling everything from roasted peanuts to paper cones of shaved ice. On stage, four microphones stood waiting under the glare of spotlights that hummed faintly in the night air. The MC, dressed in a crisp suit, stepped forward and bellowed into the mic. "Ladies and gentlemen, the Paragons." A roar went up from the audience. As the group took the stage, John Holt gave a small nod to the band. The first notes of Only a Smile floated out, and instantly the crowd swayed. The harmonies were seamless, Holt's voice cutting through with warmth and clarity. For the next hour, they had the audience in their hands, a growing catalog of hits. Following the breakout success of The Tide Is High, the Paragons poured their focus into recording and performing. The late 1960s became their golden period, with songs like Only a Smile, Were You to the Ball, and On the Beach climbing Jamaican charts and becoming staples at dances across the island. Their approach to music was methodical. Each track began with Holt bringing a melody or lyric to rehearsal. The group would then shape it together, adjusting harmonies, reworking verses, and deciding on arrangement details. They favored songs that blended romantic storytelling with melodies that were easy to remember, a formula that kept them in steady rotation on local radio. Touring Jamaica. During this era, the Paragons became one of the most in-demand live acts in Jamaica. They traveled from Kingston to rural parishes, performing at community festivals, seaside resorts, and special holiday events. Touring in those days was far from glamorous. The group often piled into small vans with their instruments and a few changes of clothes. Roads outside Kingston could be rough, and long journeys meant stopping in small towns to eat and rest before continuing on to the next gig. Despite the challenges, these tours helped them reach audiences who rarely saw major acts. For many in rural areas, a Paragon's performance was a highlight of the year. Crowds often gathered hours early, lining the edges of makeshift stages to secure the best view. The sound of rocksteady maturing. By 1968, rocksteady was evolving. While the basic offbeat guitar skank and steady bass remained, arrangements were becoming more refined. Producers were experimenting with string sections, horn arrangements, and more layered vocal harmonies. The Paragons adapted easily. Holt's smooth vocal delivery worked well against richer instrumentals, and the group's tight harmonies gave producers plenty to work with. They recorded with some of Jamaica's top session musicians, who added polish without sacrificing the organic feel of the music. In the studio, Holt's leadership was clear. He had a knack for hearing when a take was the one, often calling it before the engineers did. That confidence saved time and gave the group a reputation for professionalism. Iconic songs and cultural presence. Two songs from this period stood out for their lasting impact. On the Beach and Where You to the Ball. On the Beach captured the relaxed, joyful side of Jamaican life. Warm sand, ocean breeze, and romance under the stars. It became an anthem for seaside dances and resort shows, appealing to both locals and tourists. Where You to the Ball, on the other hand, carried a sense of aspiration and charm. Its playful lyrics and inviting rhythm made it a favorite among younger fans. Both tracks showcase the Paragon's ability to balance elegance and accessibility. Media and public recognition. By now, the Paragons were more than just a musical group. They were public figures. Their images appeared in music magazines, on concert posters, and in promotional materials for sound system events. Radio interviews became more frequent, with Holt often taking the lead in answering questions about songwriting and the group's creative process. In these interviews, Holt's humility shone through. He often credited the group's success to teamwork and the support of their producers, rarely speaking of himself as the driving force, even though many in the industry knew he was. International interest. Word of the Paragon's success reached beyond Jamaica. Record shops in the UK, especially in neighborhoods with large Caribbean populations, began importing their singles. West Indian immigrants in London, Birmingham, and Manchester embraced the music as a connection to home. This overseas interest laid the groundwork for future tours and collaborations. While the group's focus remained in Jamaica during this peak period, they were aware that a much larger audience was waiting across the Atlantic. Challenges beneath the surface. As with many groups, the pressures of constant recording and performing began to take a toll. Scheduling conflicts, creative disagreements, and the financial realities of the music business created tension. While these issues didn't immediately threaten the group's stability, they planted seeds for future changes. Holt, always dedicated to his craft, began to consider what he might achieve as a solo artist. The late 1960s marked the height of the Paragon's influence. They were at the center of Jamaica's vibrant music scene, producing songs that would define the rocksteady era and inspire generations to come. But even in these peak years, John Holt was quietly preparing for the next chapter, one where his voice would carry his name alone, without the cushion of a group. Next came a leap of faith, stepping out from the harmony into the spotlight as a solo artist. Chapter 6, Solo Career Launch. Kingston, early 1970, first solo performance. The stage was smaller than the ones John Holt had grown used to with the Paragons, but the weight on his shoulders felt heavier. No harmonies to lean on, no shared spotlight. Just him, a microphone, and a room full of people waiting to see if the voice they loved in a group could stand alone. It was a midweek night at a well-known Kingston club. The crowd was mixed, loyal Paragons fans curious about Holt's next move, industry figures listening for potential, and casual music lovers looking for a good set. The house band gave a quick nod, the lights warmed his face, and Holt stepped into the first verse of his debut single. The applause came before the song even finished. He had proven the point. John Holt, on his own, was every bit as commanding as John Holt with a group. The decision to go solo. Holt's departure from the Paragons wasn't abrupt, but it was inevitable. The group's internal pressures, combined with Holt's growing creative ambitions, led him to consider a solo career as early as the late 1960s. He wanted more freedom in song selection, arrangements, and lyrical themes. Friends recall that he never spoke negatively about the Paragons. He saw the group as family. But he also recognized that remaining in a shared format meant compromising on certain artistic choices. As a solo artist, he could follow his instincts without negotiation. First singles and early studio work. Holt's first solo sessions were lean operations. He worked with trusted producers who appreciated his natural phrasing and ability to adapt to different rhythms. His earliest singles as a solo act carried a balance of romantic ballads and socially aware tracks, a combination that would become his trademark. One of his initial standouts, recorded in a Kingston studio known for its warm, analog sound, showed that Holt could carry a song entirely on the strength of his delivery. He layered harmonies over his own lead vocals, giving the track a fullness without other singers in the room. Producers admired his precision. "When Holt walked in," one said years later, "you knew you were getting the take you needed before the night was over." Shaping a solo identity. Moving from group member to solo act required more than just changing the name on a record label. Holt had to establish an image and sound that would distinguish him from his Paragon's years. Visually, he adopted a more polished style, tailored suits for promotional photos, understated elegance on stage. Musically, he leaned deeper into the love ballads that had been fan favorites, while also exploring roots reggae arrangements that gave him space to comment on social issues. This dual approach allowed him to connect with two audiences: the romantic listener who loved his softer side, and the politically aware fan who respected his ability to speak truth through melody. First solo performances. Holt's first solo shows were carefully chosen. He performed in intimate venues where the audience could hear every nuance of his voice. This strategy built credibility. Once people heard him live without a group, their doubts vanished. The reception was immediate. Fans were impressed not only with his voice, but with his composure. On stage, Holt rarely rushed. He let silences breathe between verses, making each lyric land. Critics in local newspapers noted the maturity in his performance style. One review called him a singer who knows exactly how much to give, and never more than the song requires. Industry recognition. By his second year as a solo artist, Holt's work had caught the attention of international labels. His ability to cross from rocksteady roots into reggae and ballad territory made him a versatile asset for producers looking to market Jamaican music abroad. This recognition led to opportunities for studio collaborations and overseas performances. It also brought him into contact with arrangers who introduced new instrumental textures into his songs: strings, layered horns, and softer rhythm sections for ballads. Building a solo catalog. Within a short period, Holt began releasing singles at a steady pace. Some leaned into romantic storytelling, others carried pointed commentary on the changing political climate in Jamaica. His growing catalog showed he wasn't afraid to experiment with tempo, instrumentation, or lyrical tone. Unlike many artists who relied heavily on producers for song ideas, Holt wrote much of his own material. This ensured that even as styles shifted in the 1970s, his music retained a distinct voice. Audience loyalty. Perhaps the strongest sign of Holt's success in this period was the loyalty of his audience. Fans who had followed him from the Paragon's era stayed with him, while new listeners discovered him through his solo work. At concerts, people still called out for Paragon's hits, but they also sang along to his new material. It was clear that Holt had transitioned from being John Holt of the Paragons to simply John Holt. By the mid-1970s, John Holt's solo career was firmly established. He had proven that his voice, songwriting, and stage presence could stand alone, not as an extension of a group, but as the centerpiece of a singular career. The next chapter would cement his place in Jamaican music history, as he became the king of the love song and one of the most recognizable voices in reggae.